ashamed for my place. I'm walking with my head lowered for my race. Yes, it's easy to blame everything on the West, when in fact all focus should be on ourselves. I'm walking with my head lowered in shame for my place. I'm walking with my head lowered for my race. Yes, it's easy to blame everything on the West, when in fact all focus should be on ourselves. Is it satisfied? Is Allah satisfied? Is Allah satisfied?
We see that some of us who are short-sighted seek refuge in external means in order to seek that freedom in its total meaning, in its absolute sense. Because, on the one hand, man wishes and desires are in a state of perpetual change, and on the other, there is nothing permanent and enduring in this turbulent world. Should man's happiness depend on external things, it would always be prone to destruction. Therefore, dear brothers and sisters, such a person is like a drowning man, which clings to everything that he can catch, hold, but which cannot save him. So you're drowning and you're trying to hold something that might help you, save you. Ultimately, nothing that is transitory, that is impermanent, can give us true peace and freedom. A scholar by the name of Carlos describes the wretchedness of this group of people in these words. One abandons his beautiful mansion in order to escape the difficulties of his life and fruitlessly takes resort in various means. Another person speedily runs away from his wife and children like a fire engine hastening to extinguish a fire. But as soon as he reaches his destination, he again comes face to face with his enemy. Spiritual boredom. Thereat, he goes back with the same haste that he had gone forth, confounded and lost like a madman. These were the words of Carlos. The profound effect of suffering is severe, dear brothers and sisters, and we should not underestimate this profound effect of suffering, mental suffering, that we are talking about right now. Basically, man's creation is such that he is compelled to bear a lot of physical and spiritual hardships in order to satisfy the needs of his life. Because it is in the course of this toil and hardship and endeavor for obtaining the material means of life that his intellectual and spiritual faculties acquire their growth. Without any difficulties, dear brothers and sisters, we would not evolve. We would not develop, neither spiritually, nor mentally, nor physically.
Your mercy, your love is all I need. It's
Our voice comes from the heart of beautiful Iran. This is the Heart of Life Pounding. IRIB English Radio.
Africa Today.
The United States deployed the first naval ship to Eastern Africa in over a decade in what is a pointer to a new approach by the Joe Biden administration, which appears intent on using military power to pursue American imperialism in Africa. The expeditionary sea-based USS Herschel Woody Williams had been deployed along the eastern and Horn of Africa coastal region. Rear Admiral Jeffrey Spavey, the ship's captain, gives a hint here on Washington's new military strategy in Africa.
We look forward to working with the Kenyan Navy on future exercises such as Cutlass Express. Cutlass Express is a partnership-building evolution where we will look to improve our maritime domain awareness. Our maritime domain awareness in conjunction with our regional maritime operations centers.
Hello, I'm Mubarak Kenya, and a warm welcome to this week's edition of Africa Today, a program which brings you an in-depth analysis on events happening in Africa. In our program today, we are focusing on renewed American military adventurism in Africa. We are asking, what's Biden's military strategy in Africa? In the second part of our program, we shall update you on the Mauritius oil spill. In this regard, a top British multinational oil and gas company, BP, has been blamed for this disastrous oil spill, but refuses to take responsibility.
Biden's military strategy in Africa. Immediately after the November presidential election in the United States, high-ranking military officials from the country visited several African countries. The visit by these top Pentagon officials points to a new aggressive U.S. military strategy in Africa. Early January, General Jeffrey Harigian, the commander of U.S. Air Forces in Europe and Africa, traveled to Camp Limonier in Djibouti. He later visited Tunisia and Algeria. During this tour, he met key defense leaders in the region. The visit was immediately followed by that of the head of the U.S. Africa Command, AFRICOM, to five East African nations.
Now, according to some reports, currently the U.S. has 7,000 military personnel on rotational deployment across Africa. These troops are reportedly in the continent to carry out joint operations with African forces against terrorists. However, many Africans are opposed to the U.S. military presence in the continent, as this Ghanaian here speaks out during a protest against U.S. military presence in her country.
I'm a mother, and we know what these Americans do. We know that these Americans has a lot of enemies. And by coming to, settle their base here, we are not safe. And that's the reason why I have to join this campaign, to create awareness.
For more on the United States military strategy in Africa under a Joe Biden administration, we have contacted NAFTA Freeman, a coordinating committee member of the Black Alliance for Peace. Thanks a lot for your time, Mr. Freeman. Now, we've seen that after Biden's victory, high-ranking U.S. military officials visited several African countries. Now, does this point to renewed militarization of U.S. foreign policy in Africa?
Yes, I think we can expect to see renewed militarization. Some of the things that the Trump administration did were adverse to the ruling class interest in the United States, the ruling class imperialist interest. They felt, the establishment felt, that Trump was neglecting their imperialist interest in Africa, doing things, for example, like pulling out troops on the ground in Somalia, or the also the Trump move to relocate the headquarters of AFRICOM, which has been placed in Stuttgart, Germany, they've actually put a halt on that and said that they're going to be revisiting this issue. They looked at the Trump administration, Trump himself looked at things like looking at America first and not really so interested or understanding the integral relationship that the exploitation of Africa had to do with the system he's trying to uphold. But now, since he's out of office, they're going to try to shore up some of those things and see if they can intensify the exploitation of the African continent.
Thanks for that, Nestor Freeman, an African-American peace activist. And stay tuned for more.
Over 8 years of Obama presidency, Africa saw an escalation of U.S. aerial campaigns, proxy warfare, and imperial competition. Somalia has been the key target for U.S. drone strikes that intensified under Trump's administration. During both Obama and Trump administrations, civilians bore the brunt of the attacks carried out by the U.S. military. What strategies will likely be pursued by the U.S. military under Biden in Africa? Can we expect to see similar policies pursued by Obama?
Yes. Under Obama, the policy was to expand AFRICOM. When AFRICOM, the militarization of the continent, which is really the recolonization of the continent, United States wasn't able to get on the formal colonization, as it will, of Africa. But even after the independence movements during the 50s, 60s, 70s, the United States shored up and became actually the leading power in terms of neocolonialism on the continent. And under President Barack Obama, U.S. President Barack Obama, they were able to actually realize for AFRICOM, the establishment of their U.S. Africa Command, what they couldn't do when it was established under Bush, which was the proliferation of African lily pad bases and military-to-military relationships on the continent.
China is clearly the United States' main competitor in Africa. With the tensions between Washington and Beijing expected to rise during Biden's presidency, Africa could be a new battleground for these two world powers. Strategically located Djibouti is an example of the ongoing military contest between China and the U.S. in Africa. The Chinese government says its military base in Djibouti is meant to promote peace and stability in Africa.
Setting up the support base in Djibouti was a joint decision of the two countries. It will better let China fulfill its responsibilities in the international community and promote peace and stability in Africa and in the world.
The Senate confirmation hearing for Linda Thomas-Greenfield, Joe Biden's nominee to be U.S. ambassador to the United Nations, provided clues on Washington's aggressive policy to counter China in Africa.
China is a strategic adversary, and their actions threaten our security, they threaten our values, and they threaten our way of life. And they are a threat to their neighbors, and they are a threat across the globe. So I have no doubts in my mind about that. As I talk about that in the speech and referring to the Cold War, again, I'm referring to Africa.
Mr. Freeman, now do you think under Biden, Africa will turn into a theater for U.S.-China Cold War?
Yes, I think we're already seeing some of that. We saw some of that going before, and we definitely will see more of that. The United States is unable to compete with China in the terms of economic strength and its economic ingenuity. And so the only thing that the United States, in its unsustainable system of neoliberal capitalism, the only thing it has to resort to is militarism and war. And so, and militarism itself has become, a business, an industry itself. And so for them, the competition has to be a physical one because they can't compete economically in terms of how their system is designed. And so as a result of that, and the United States is not willing, there's no way that it's going to even consider. The ruling class in the United States is not going to consider cooperation, internationalist cooperation or internationalism. That's something outside of their purview.
Most parts of Africa have seen an increase of terrorist attacks despite the presence of Western forces, especially U.S. troops in the region, which claim to combat terrorism. U.S. troops have been operating in Africa for many years on the pretext of combating terrorism, but terrorist attacks have continued unabated in several parts of the continent.
Well, the studies have shown that not only have they've gone unabated, but they've actually increased. And anytime you have colonial forces operating in a country, making that country unable to meet the needs of its people in any kind of way, you're aggravating a situation. Now, in Africa, they make sure that no real genuine revolutionary socialist movements or governments can take root that will be able to be responsive to the needs of the people. So the people will resort to more reactionary forms of resistance, like with terrorism. And in fact, the terrorism on the continent of Africa or the military operations on the continent of Africa breed resentment, and people get killed, and their family members are died, and they join extremist groups. So, which actually helps serve the purpose of the U.S. presence on the continent of Africa. It gives them the excuse to continue their occupation and to super exploit Africa for its resources and labor and markets.
Mr. Freeman, as we wind up this interview, can you tell us what needs to be done by African people to combat imperialism and stop turning parts of the continent into U.S. military bases?
I think it's largely, or in a lot of ways rather, in a lot of ways not largely, the people on the ground have to organize. They have to realize the purpose of these forces in their countries. It's not for any kind of liberation. It's not to combat terrorism. They have to know that they're there for neo-colonial means. And what also has to happen, though, is that it's largely incumbent on population in the United States, people in the U.S., particularly people of African descent, that need to make those connections to stand up and call for a complete, unequivocal, unconditional shutdown of AFRICOM, withdrawal of all U.S. military presence on the continent of Africa. And so that has to, the call has to come and organize, and substantial call has to come from inside the United States, and those people calling for that in the United States and the people on the ground in Africa have to link up to make this cause, to strengthen it.
Mr. Freeman there says that masses in Africa must organize and demand a withdrawal of U.S. troops in Africa.
Petroleum blamed for Mauritius oil spill.
Last August, a Japanese cargo ship MV Wakashio ran aground on a coral reef off the coast of Mauritius, leaking up to 1,000 tons of heavy oil into a pristine lagoon. A top British multinational oil and gas company has been blamed for this devastating oil spill. Recently released documents show that BP was behind the very low sulfur fuel used by the tanker. BP has also formally blocked an investigation into the fuel, which was reportedly known to be faulty from the moment the Japanese bulk carrier set off from Singapore.
As reported by Forbes, Japanese shipping giant Mitsui O.S.K. Lines had been aware that the very low sulfur fuel oil exceeded engine safety limits. BP issued a statement confirming that it supplied the oil used in the Wakashio. However, BP denied that the fuel was faulty. The environmental crisis unfolding in Mauritius is a stark reminder of the fragility of terrestrial marine ecosystems. Let's have a glimpse of just how the concerned Mauritians volunteered to clean the area damaged by the oil spill, which is near a popular tourism site environmentally protected area.
And that's what is nice with this pipe. It takes only oil, no water. The job is being done, and it will take time. The only thing that we need to just put in mind, it won't be done in a week. It's impossible.
The devastation of the Mauritius oil spill is yet to be fully addressed, while no major action has been taken to protect the island's waters from a future incident. Now, for more on the Mauritius oil spill and BP's rejection of responsibility, we have contacted Julius Mbaluto, a London-based African affairs analyst. Thanks a lot for your time, Mr. Mbaluto. Now, British Petroleum BP has denied responsibility for the devastating oil spill in Mauritius, but the evidence appears incriminating. Where is the truth on this matter?
The ship carrying that particular oil arrived in Mauritius, and also BP acknowledges having the fuel, you know, selling it to that company, MOL, in Japan, that was to transport that oil. So it's the truth is a bit murky here, because there are denials, them denying it, but also investigations have not been carried properly, because also what it is, it seems like, you know, BP was trying to block the evidence. So there are things that are not really adding up. BP has denied. Legally, we can only say they denied. We cannot say they did it, because they are denying, and perhaps it's a matter that is subject to more investigation in the future. But where we are right now, it doesn't add up that they are saying they have not done it, yet the evidence show a totally different story.
Thanks a lot, Mr. Julius Mbaluto, African Affairs Analyst in London.
The Mauritius oil spill has been described as one of the worst ecological disasters ever to hit the Western Indian Ocean. Yet the Mauritian government, Japanese shipowner Nakashiki Shipping, and fuel supplier BP are withholding crucial information that could aid cleanup efforts and prevent future shipwrecks.
Mr. Mbaluto, you talked there about investigations. Now, what is the state of investigations on these matters, and is BP cooperating with authorities?
Where we are right now, BP has not allowed proper investigations to be conducted. There are allegations from document released through the Freedom of Information Act. These documents incriminate BP. They're saying BP seems to have colluded, or probably IMO, which is the United Nations arm of shipping, arm of handling matters on the seas, rather. They seem to have known, actually, according to this document, they seem to have known that BP had this oil. So all these revelations have come through investigations, but they are not investigations that BP is cooperating. Number one, they tried to hide the truth by saying not responsible, but I think it was in January this year when they came across and acknowledged having sold this particular oil to MOL.
Now, Mr. Mbaluto, you said there that BP is stonewalling investigations into the disaster in Mauritius. Why will they do this if they are innocent and have nothing to hide?
They will be quick, definitely, to deny responsibility. Why? Because the consequences are very stern. When you look into the things that go wrong because of disaster like this, effects are so much, and if Mauritius was to claim for compensation, and also when BP took responsibility, you'd be talking about health issues, effects are touching on health of the people, the communities, because these are chemicals landed on the ground. They're gonna definitely affect people on the ground. We are talking about economic impact to their environment. We're talking about the well-being of the people.
So basically, what is clear is that BP is refusing to accept responsibility of the oil spill it caused in Mauritius to avoid paying compensation, which will probably run into billions of dollars.
Campaigners are critical of the very little compensation offered to affected communities. The government set up a Wakashiu Solidarity Grant for around 3,000 people, offering them a one-time pay out of 500. According to maritime law, the shipowner is responsible for damage caused by an oil spill. The Japanese government expressed commitment to mitigation efforts. How has the spill impacted on the fragile ecosystem of the affected area?
We are talking about economic impact to their environment. We are talking about the well-being of the people. We are talking about the biodiversity hotspots in Indian Ocean. When you look into this biodiversity, you are talking about the life in the sea itself, which is so critical.
The oil spill in Mauritius was also disastrous for local communities. These marginalized communities are expected to endure economic hardships and long-term health implications, which are already visible.
And that's like 2 weeks, my head, when I go to sleep, is like big head dash, you know? Like it's not only me, it's everywhere in the local people near coastal here. And the ice was burning also. I could see doctor for that.
Now, Mr. Mbaluto, this pattern of Western oil multinationals shirking responsibilities, especially after destroying the environment, is repeated across Africa and beyond. Now, what needs to be done to hold to account these multinationals, which appear to be acting with impunity?
I think the first thing to do is to recognize the only body responsible to regulate maritime issues is IMO, and IMO, of course, is part of United Nations. And therefore, when we talk about international territories, crisscrossing international territories, especially in maritime area, we are talking about a form of regulation that will correct all these wrongs and probably prepare the world for more preventive measures rather than reactive measures when things go wrong. So we are talking about we require serious major reforms within the International Maritime Organization, IMO. We require serious, reinforcement of the legislation that's already there. We require monitoring systems.
Well, thanks for your insight, Mr. Mbaluto. It's quite clear that international oil multinationals need to take responsibility by compensating communities affected by their recklessness and disregard for the environment. Now, thanks a lot, and on behalf of the entire Africa Today team, take care and goodbye.
In the limelight.
British women flooded social media with posts about the steps they take when out alone at night to keep safe, including clutching keys to use as a weapon and wearing trainers to help them run. Many raged at the violence against women that made them feel they had to take such measures. I prepare for you an article written jointly by Michael Holden and David Milliken under the heading London Murder Case Triggers Wave of Grief, Rage Over Threats to Women. The article has been published by the Reuters News Agency. Please stay with us for more of Michael Holden and David Milliken's article. Women in Britain poured out their fears and anger over how unsafe they feel walking the streets after the disappearance of a woman in Clapham, South London, and the arrest of a police officer on suspicion of a kidnap and murder. Sarah Eberard, a 33-year-old, was last seen at 9:30 p.m. local time on 3rd of March as she walked home from a friend's house in South London. Her image, smiling at the camera or caught on CCTV that evening, has been splashed across British newspapers all week. Anxiety turned to grief after news late on Wednesday, 3rd of March, that police investigating Eberard's disappearance had found remains in a wood outside London, resulting in an outpouring of personal accounts by women of their own experiences and fears. Anna Burley, a 31-year-old, one of the organisers of a planned Reclaim These Streets vigil to honour Sarah Eberard and demand change, said, "The disappearance of Sarah and the absolute tragedy around that has really touched a nerve with a lot of women." Anna Burley said, "We feel really angry that it's an expectation put on women that we need to change our behaviour to stay safe. The problem isn't women, the problem is that women aren't safe on our streets." Women flooded social media with posts about the steps they take when out alone at night to keep safe, including clutching keys to use as a weapon and wearing trainers to help them run. Many raged at the violence against women that made them feel they had to take such measures. Others detailed a catalogue of incidents of harassment by men in public over the decades since they were schoolgirls. Britain's Home Secretary Priti Patel said, "These are so powerful because each and every woman can relate," adding, "Every woman should feel safe to walk on our streets without fear of harassment or violence." Legislator Jess Phillips, the opposition Labour Party's policy chief on domestic violence, read out in the Chamber of the House of Commons the names of all 118 women murdered by men in the United Kingdom last year. Jessica Phillips said, "The message that needs to be sent is that male violence is something that has to be tackled and challenged, and the justice system and society has to wake up to that." The head of London's police force, Cressida Dick, said she and her colleagues were utterly appalled at news that a police officer had been arrested in connection with Sarah Eberard's abduction, sparking a wave of shock and anger. Police on Thursday, 4th of March, were given extra time to question the officer, whose job is to guard diplomatic buildings, on suspicion of kidnap, murder, and indecent exposure. A woman in her 30s, whom media reports said was his wife, was also detained on suspicion of assisting an offender, but has since been released on police bail. England's police watchdog, the Independent Office for Police Conduct, said it had launched an investigation into the London Police Force's handling of the case. The arrested police officer was reported to police on 28th of February over charges of indecent exposure in a South London fast food restaurant, several days before Sarah Eberard's disappearance. The watchdog also said it would look closer at how the suspect sustained head injuries that required hospital treatment, which police said occurred whilst he was alone in his prison cell. Head of London's police force, Cressida Dick, sought to reassure women, claiming it was incredibly rare for a woman to be abducted from the streets. She said, "But I completely understand that despite this, women in London and the wider public, particularly those in the area where Sarah went missing, will be worried and may well be feeling scared." Although the remains have not yet been formally identified, Sarah Eberard's family paid tribute, saying their daughter Sarah was taken from us and we are appealing for any information that will help to solve this terrible crime. The family said in a statement, Sarah was a wonderful daughter and sister. She was kind and thoughtful, caring and dependable. Britain's Prime Minister Boris Johnson said he was shocked and deeply saddened by developments in this case. The Reclaim These Streets vigil will take place in coming days in Clapham Common in southwest London, near where Sarah Everard was last seen. The event's organiser wrote on Facebook, "We believe that streets should be safe for women regardless of what you wear, where you live, or what time of the day or night it is." The statement added, "It's wrong that the response to violence against women requires women to behave differently." In comments on social media, women have also been offering to help each other walk together to the event in groups to keep each other safe. Organisers of the Clapham Common Vigil said that police officers had told them the event would not be allowed given current COVID-19 restrictions. Writing on a crowdfunding website to cover legal fees, organisers said they were working with human rights lawyers to challenge the Metropolitan Police's interpretation of coronavirus legislation and are seeking an urgent order from the High Court for the event to go ahead.
This is A to Z. An introduction to Islamic lifestyle. Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. In the name of Allah, the Most Beneficent, the Most Merciful. Dear brothers and sisters, Assalamu alaikum. Peace and blessings of Allah be upon you all. This is A to Z, coming to you from IRIB English Radio, and I'm your host, Ali. This radio show is about Islamic lifestyle, and in each episode, we will be talking about a different lesson. Please stay with us till the end of today's program. Today's lesson, with whom shall we consult? Consultation is one of the important Islamic instructions. But while consultation with the right persons helps in improvements and corrective actions, consulting those with certain weaknesses is harmful. Imam Ali alayhi salam recommends that we strictly avoid consulting, especially in the important social affairs, with those who are miser or timid or greedy. One of them prevents man from munificence of divine graces, and the other weakens his resolve. And the third encourages man to violate rights of others out of greed. Shura is an Arabic word for consultation. The Quran and Prophet Muhammad sallallahu alaihi wasallam encourage Muslims to decide their affairs in consultation with those who will be affected by that decision, the stakeholders. The principle of Shura can, for example, take the form of a council or referendum. Now, brothers and sisters, consultation is something that not everybody takes too seriously, unfortunately. Why? Because they think I'm more smarter than other people, I am more intelligent than other people, so they never consult other people. We have a hadith and we have traditions where the infallibles have informed us that if somebody does not consult with others, that somebody sooner or later is going to have to face the detriments of not consulting. So consultation with the wise people out there is something very important for all of them, elderly people, our parents, you know, our siblings, even our friends who are
decent and can think through things, do consult with them and make it a habit. Then, based on this consultation, you can make your decisions. Welcome back to your listeners. Today we are discussing with whom shall we consult. So there is one group of people who does not consult with anyone because they are those haughty and sometimes arrogant, overconfident people who think they know everything. And then there are other people who consult, anyone who is around them. They don't even look at their credentials. They don't care like how intelligent and smart they are. They just consult with every single person around them. And then in the end, they get confused, right? Islam promotes consultation, but with a few types of people, Islam has recommended us to be not in a consultative mode. Imam Ali alayhi salam says, do not consult with misers because they prevent you from service to people and frighten you from poverty. And do not consult with timid people because they weaken your will to perform important tasks. And do not consult with greedy persons because they beautify injustice to you. So see how the three have a negative effect and impact in your decision making and in your life. So miser people, if you consult with them, their consultation is going to prevent you from, helping others, for instance, because they would make you afraid. Oh, if you help others, let's say financially, just one of the examples, then you're going to become poor and you are going to run into issues, financial issues. Then timid people, what they do is like they make you insecure about everything. They weaken your resolve. And then the greedy people, they are going to give you a consultation which may end up being an active catalyst for you to go ahead and violate the rights of other innocent human beings. So you should know that you have to be consultative, but at the same time, refrain from consulting every Tom, Dick, and Harry. Dear listeners of IRIB English Radio, thank you very much for staying with us till the end of today's episode of A to Z. Don't forget to log on to our website at www.parstoday.com, Call of Islam page. We leave you all in the care of Allah. Till next time, wassalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
Diverse range of programs, spirituality, youth, Eastern tales. Roundtable discussions. Culture. Politics. All produced by IRIB English Radio.
in the limelight.
Georgia lawmakers have advanced a measure that would significantly curtail voting access after a record number of voters propelled Democratic victories in the 2020 race. The measure scraped through 29-20 in the GOP-controlled Georgia Senate, which was the absolute minimum number of votes Republicans needed. Four Republicans, including some in competitive races, sat out the vote, according to the Atlanta Journal-Constitution. The article you're about to hear has been written by The Guardian columnist Sam Levine. The piece is titled "Outrage as Georgia Republicans Advance Bill to Restrict Voting Access." Please stay with us for more of Sam Levine's article. Georgia lawmakers have advanced a measure that would significantly curtail voting access after a record number of voters propelled Democratic victories in the 2020 presidential race. The measure scraped through 29-20 in the GOP-controlled Georgia Senate, which was the absolute minimum number of votes Republicans needed. Four Republicans, including some in competitive races, sat out the vote, according to the Atlanta Journal-Constitution. The bill, SB 241, would end the right to vote by mail without having to provide an excuse, a policy that Georgia Republicans implemented in the state back in 2005. More than 1.3 million people voted by mail in the 2020 presidential election in the state. Under the bill, only people aged 65 years and older or who have one of a handful of state-approved excuses would be allowed to vote by mail. Just 16 other states currently require a voter to give an excuse to vote by mail. The legislation also would require voters to provide identification information, such as a driver's license number, both when they apply to vote by mail and when they return the ballot. Republicans have frequently held up the specter of voter fraud to justify such restrictions. Though there were several vote recounts in Georgia in the 2020 presidential race, as well as audits and officials found no such wrongdoing. Mike Duggan, the Republican state senator who sponsored the bill, said the lack of widespread fraud should not be an impediment to changing election rules. "You don't wait until you have wholesale issues until you try to meet the need," he said. "You do it beforehand." He also said on the Senate floor on Monday, 8th of March, that the bill was needed to reduce the burden on local election officials and to ensure that voters were not disenfranchised. State Senator Elena Parent, a Democrat, said the justification for the bill was a weaponization of Donald Trump's lies about the election. "It is a willingness and embrace of damage to American democracy," she said. "The numbers to stop this bill may not be here in this chamber today, but I assure you there are many thousands of Georgians right now whose political spirit is awakened by disgust at modern-day voter suppression." A stream of Democrats criticized the measure as a thinly veiled effort to suppress black and other minority voters in Georgia. Those groups contributed to record turnout in the state in 2020 and helped propel Joe Biden, as well as Democrat senatorial candidates John Ossoff and Raphael Warnock, to stunning victories in the state. "I know racism when I see it," said Gail Davenport, a Democrat who recalled watching the Ku Klux Klan marching on Saturdays in Jonesboro, just south of Atlanta, Georgia. This is not about the process. This is about suppressing the vote of a certain group of people, especially me and people who look like me, and I take it personally. The bill will now go on to Georgia House of Representatives, which last week approved its own set of voting restrictions, including new limits on early voting and drop boxes. It remains unclear which proposals will ultimately be sent to the governor's desk once each chamber fully considers the opposite chamber's bill. Lawmakers have until 31st of March to send the bill to Governor Brian Kemp's desk, according to the Atlanta Journal-Constitution. In the last two election cycles, we saw a dramatic increase in the number of voters of color who voted by mail, the number of young people who used early voting, the number of African Americans who voted on Saturday and Sunday. Stacey Abrams, the former Georgia gubernatorial candidate, told Mother Jones. We saw unprecedented levels of turnout across the board, and so every single metric of voter access that has been a good in Georgia is now under attack. Top Republicans in the state, including Lieutenant Governor Jeff Duncan, have said they oppose efforts to get rid of no-excuse absentee voting, and Jeff Duncan refused to preside over the Senate on Monday as it considered the measure to do just that. At several points during the debate, which stretched around 3 hours on Monday afternoon, Democrats connected the policies under consideration to those in the Jim Crow South. They noted that some members of the legislature had lived through those policies. Harold Jones II, another Democratic state senator, urged his colleagues to pay attention to black lawmakers who spoke out against the bill. It's because that most basic right was denied to us. It's not 1800, it's not 1850s, it's right here in this room. Many of the senators that sit here lived through that process, he said. Let me tell you, it is not theater, it is not a performance. It's real because we lived with it every single day.
بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم السلام عليكم ورحمة الله
Selection of Ayatollah Khamenei's viewpoints
همه با وجود قده سرطانی اسرائیل مخالفیم
All of us are opposed to the cancerous tumor Israel
وجه مشترک همه وحدت امت اسلامی
Unity of Islamic Ummah is the aspect that all of Islamic denominations have in common.
This is a part of a speech delivered on February 17, 2021 by Ayatollah Khamenei, the leader of the Islamic Revolution, via video conference with the participation of people from Tabriz and East Azerbaijan commemorating the anniversary of the Tabriz uprising of February 18, 1978.
Confronting the enemy by strengthening national identity. Well, from the beginning, the Islamic Revolution faced the enmity of superpowers, and a certain front came into being. One day, they brought up the issue of the nuclear issue, and another day, they brought up the issue of missiles and Iran's regional presence. These are all excuses. The essence of the issue is that the Islamic government is not willing to be a partner to the global system of domination, and it does not wish to cooperate with it in the oppressor-oppressed division of the world. The Islamic government is standing up against oppression and hegemony. Well, in the face of this enmity and this front, our dear and eternal nation needs to strengthen its identity, its personality, and its identity elements, and it should increase its inner powers as well. This is a definite need. What gives identity and power to a nation and a movement? First of all, having a firm ideological infrastructure.
Your light and love, all I see, nothing more I'd ever want to need. My Lord, protect me from dishonor, grant me faith to be stronger.
The reason why many countries which conducted a revolution and made moves against hegemony, arrogance, oppression and tyranny returned from their path after a short time, some after 5 years, some after 10 years, and took the path of their predecessors and behaved like them was that they did not have a firm ideological infrastructure. When you see foreigners use certain terms, unfortunately, some people inside the country repeat it as well. Such as combating ideology. This is what it means. The main enemy of hegemonic powers is this fundamental ideological infrastructure, which is an Islamic one. This infrastructure is based on Islam, and it has been explained in detail in Imam's statements. This Islamic ideological infrastructure is completely radiant there, and our late Imam's wealth of statements is a rich source of information in this regard.
Alhamdulillah, Alhamdulillah, all praises to Allah, all praises to Allah. Alhamdulillah, Alhamdulillah, all praises to Allah, all praises to Allah.
Around the World with Reporters.
In Arze Ruzemo.
Leader of Iran's Islamic Revolution, Ayatollah Sayyid Ali Khamenei, has denounced the policies of the United States. In his speech marking the occasion of Eid al-Mab'ath, Ayatollah Khamenei slammed Washington for building military bases in the region under the pretext of fighting terrorism and called for the withdrawal of U.S. troops from Iraq and Syria. Ayatollah Khamenei said Washington is the only country that has used nuclear weapons in action, but it claims to be against weapons of mass destruction. He noted that Washington still has the biggest nuclear arsenal in the world. Iran's leader also accused Washington of turning a blind eye as its Arab allies keep bombarding civilians in Yemen. He pointed out that Washington and even the United Nations, however, raised an outcry as soon as the people of Yemen started defending themselves against the Saudi-led aggressors. Elsewhere in his remarks, Ayatollah Khamenei said the United States is inverting the truth by claiming to support human rights while supporting those who violate them. Washington's double standards were also highlighted in remarks made by Iran's foreign minister. In a tweet, Mohammad Javad Zarif said the new U.S. administration is still sticking to a policy of maximum pressure against Iran but claims to favor diplomacy. Zarif also denounced Washington's move to block the release of Iranian assets frozen in South Korea. He noted that Iran needs the fund to purchase food and medicine as the country is fighting to contain the spread of the new coronavirus. Iran's foreign minister made the comments after U.S. Secretary of State Antony Blinken announced Washington's opposition to unfreezing of the Iranian funds by South Korea. Blinken said the money will only be released when Iran returns to full compliance with the 2015 nuclear deal. Tehran, however, says it will only reverse its commitment cuts once Washington removes all its unilateral sanctions against the Islamic Republic. Iranian officials argue it was the U.S. that threw the agreement into crisis by its withdrawal and must therefore be the one who returns to it first. On the surface, it looks like the new administration in the White House has chosen to adopt less hawkish policies and engage more with the world. But in reality, little has changed since Joe Biden took the helm in January. Eyes are now on the Biden administration to see whether Washington will choose to give up its bullying or keep on the same beaten track.